I'm Tom Slav, Executive Director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. I want to put something on the table that I keep coming back to with our members. When a tech company talks about AI, almost every one of them writes half a sentence. First half is, how do we use AI to take cost out, get more efficient, do more with fewer people? And look, that's a real half. That's a big story there. But it's not the complete sentence. The second half, the part most companies haven't gotten to yet, is what new value do we create that we never could before? And here's the kicker. The part we've been chipping on, you cannot write that second half of the sentence without your people. You can't grind your way to a workforce that says, heck, yes, let's go build something nobody ever built. That's the half of the sentence this episode is about, how to really inspire the workforce around AI. My guest today is Sarah DiMuccio, a social psychologist who works with global companies on the human side of AI transformation, not the technology rollout, the people rollout. And while a lot of the industry is obsessing over upskilling and AI fluency, Sarah's doing something most leaders are skipping entirely. She's studying what actually makes people want to follow a leader into something this scary. She's talking about psychological safety and the difference between bringing people along and dragging them along. And honestly, it's some of the sharpest thinking I've heard on the people side of AI in a while. And so I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Let's get the insight engine humming. Sarah, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you so much, Thomas. I'm excited to be here.
So this is going to be fun. I watched this 11-minute keynote that you did talking about AI adoption and managing people through it. And what really struck me is this thing about resentment, the pushback that we're starting to see in employees, and cuts across everything. Age, seniority, gender, job type, all the stuff that people say, well, people are acting differently. This cuts across all of that. So set the table here for everybody. What are you actually seeing in the wild right now when companies roll out AI, and why is the human reaction, you know, the nervousness so universal?
Such a great question. As a psychologist, I think I can really bring a lot of insight here that we sometimes forget, which is that it's not resistance in the sort of typical sense of just people digging in their heels and saying, I don't want to do this. It's really this kind of threat calculation that people are doing in real time, right? Across mm-hmm. these levels and roles, people are asking themselves, does this make me less competent, less valued, less needed, right? And it cuts across all of this because it's not threatening tasks. It's threatening how we think about ourselves, the story that we have about who we are at work. So it's not a demographic problem. It's a psychological one. It's a human problem, right? Yeah. And we all have to have a sense of, you know, we're protecting the same things, right? We need to feel competent. We need to feel like we're actually good at something. We need to feel like we're valuable. And how can that be valuable if everyone has the same tools? And we also need to feel like we have a sense of identity, right? Am I still the person, the professional that I've been spending decades, years building? And if I'm not there yet, will I ever become that professional that I saw myself becoming?
As I listen to you, what's interesting is, again, this concept of feeling valuable. AI is a unique technology because it threatens every knowledge work position out there. It's not unique to a position. It's not like when spreadsheets came along and accountants felt threatened and that was unique, right? This is like AI threatens everybody. It doesn't matter what kind of world you're in. So it's very unique there. And I'm going to put some data on the table here. So we did this poll of our executive advisory board a couple months ago, and we were asking about how they were managing the rollout of AI and the training of it for that. And less than 15% of those companies said they had a real structured program in place. And I was talking to a guy who does implementation software around AI, and he was telling me he's watching companies invest in the technology side of AI, but not the training side, not the enablement side. And to me, that's kind of crazy. So why is that? Why are companies pouring so much money into the technology and damn near nothing into the training enablement side?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think it's a gap that a lot of people are really noticing, right? This huge gap between the billions of dollars that are being put, trillions even, into AI and the just minuscule amount that's being put into training. And I think the short answer is that one is quantifiable and the other isn't, right? you can put a number on a software license or an AI company, right? It gets funded because you can quantify it. Whereas human adaptation is messy, it's slow, it's hard to measure. And it also sort of is treated at this downstream free assumption, right? It's just going to happen once we switch on the tool. So this is a huge category error, right? Leaders are sort of buying and using this as if it's a software instead of as a work redesign.
Yeah.
Used to be, you know, here's where the buttons are. So we just need to show you that and you'll be good to go. But with AI, enablement is here's how your judgment, your expertise, your workflow, and your identity actually change, which is obviously a huge lift.
Yeah. As I listen to you, it strikes me there's now this sort of irony. In traditional software rollout, again, you roll out a new software tool for the workforce because you said, you know, you got to teach them, you know, what buttons to push. And people go, oh yeah, I got to train people on that. I don't assume that this software lands on their desk and they magically know what buttons to push, right? So you would do a certain amount of dollars and time on training. AI comes along. And the irony here is the fact that we're underinvesting in the training, just assuming they're going to know what to do. And yet, a lot more upheaval, a lot more training. Because like you said, it's about completely rethinking how you're doing your job, not pushing some buttons. So the lift is higher in terms of enablement. And the investment, ironically, is proving to be lower right now. So it makes no sense to me whatsoever. So, you know, you made a distinction. I mean, first time you and I talked, that stuck in my mind. We all talk about employees sabotaging AI. But you said the bigger thing isn't sabotage, it's detracting. The quiet, you know, is not for me. Like, I don't want to do this. So talk more about that, this sort of quiet checkout. So I'm not sabotaging, but quiet checkout, and why you think that that's perhaps the bigger issue.
It's a bigger issue exactly for the reason that you say, is that it's quiet. It's way more common. It's not that sort of, hey, I don't want to do this, or I'm actually going to actively push back. It's, you know, that sort of polite opting out. It's they're technically compliant, but they're not really changing how they work. And it doesn't look like resistance. So it's not. There was a recent study that was written about in Forbes that found that globally 43% of workers bypassed their company's AI tools in the past 30 days and completed the work manually instead, which I think to some people sounds insane, right? Because this is something that's supposed to help them be more efficient. And this is, again, back to another gap that we see, which is that up to 90% of executives say that their employees have the tools that they need, but only 20% of the workers actually agree. So the leaders are not even seeing it. Even if they wanted to, they think that everybody is good to go. And that makes it doubly difficult to manage, right? Because it's happening behind the scenes and they're not even able to see it based on their own biases.
Yeah. And I think to me, what's interesting on how this is unfolding, I was talking to an executive literally after you and I spoke last time. And I was talking about this challenge of AI adoption and how they're dealing with it at their company. I shared with you a report, sort of these categories of people, right, in terms of the sabotagers versus whatever. Yeah. And the executive looked at that and said, well, the people that are sabotaging, if we identify that, they're gone. That's how we deal with it. They are gone. And it's like, and I heard that and I get that. I get that, right? But it is the quiet non-adoption that is an executive, to your point, if you can't really see that. It's not in your face. It's not super obvious. You can't point to it and say, hey, you're out. But it is going to slow you down. And you just don't know how much it's slowing you down. So is that costing you 10%, 20%, 40% in terms of how fast you could be moving on this stuff? You don't have your arms around it. So I think it's a real problem out there.
Yeah. And you don't find out about it until it's too late, right? Because it breaks the learning loop. And then you find out months later when the numbers come in flat.
Yeah, you didn't get the ROI. You didn't get what you thought you know, you were going to get. And I think what a lot of leaders don't have their head around is that they think that enablement in general for AI is, hey, we got everybody a Copilot license. It's like, here's this really cool AI tool and it's so easy to use. You just talk to it and go do really cool things with it. But you can think something is cool, right? And still sit there thinking, if I really lean into this, A, what do I do with it? And also, am I really just training my replacement, which is, as you put on the table, is a real issue. So how do leaders put these tools on the table and help their employees think in a good way about it? And I think also leaders have to be honest about the fact that they do expect efficiencies. I mean, I think that's another issue that we identify. AI first got on the table as asking leaders, you know, what do you think about AI? And the story to the employees was, I've used this term before on this podcast, rainbows and unicorns, and it's all going to be great. But then you talk to them off the record and they'd be like, oh yeah, we definitely are going to slow down hiring or reduce workforce, whatever. That was already in the thinking from day one. So how do leaders, again, put this on a way that is not just like, here's this cool tool, figure it out. And oh, by the way, don't worry about what this is going to do to our workforce configurations. What do you think there?
I mean, it's so hard, right? Because there's always this balance that has to be struck in any organization by any leader about transparency and honesty and not actually terrifying people, right? You can't just be honest about everything. At the same time, you can't out-demo fear, right? If somebody privately thinks that getting good at this tool is going to speed up their own redundancy, no amount of look at how cool this is going to help that. So. Yeah. I do think that we should name the elephant in the room. I do think that the fear has to be named directly. We have this idea that if we just talk around it, then that will address the problem. But if we name it and then we meet that with honesty rather than the sort of false sense of reassurance, right? If headcount is going to be genuinely uncertain, then I think we have to say that, not in a sense of there's nothing we can do, but more people can handle uncertainty more than I think we think they can. And they're more likely to forgive that than to feel like they're being lied to or that they're being managed around the truth. So not saying, hey, look, half of you might be fired tomorrow, but rather I also am not sure where this is going to lead. But regardless, learning these tools is going to help you in your future.
Yeah. I want to chip into that one a little bit because even myself personally, as leadership team on a research firm, AI has changed dramatically the way that we do research, and we've had to navigate that for the past couple of years. And, you know, my personal approach on it, and I'm not saying this is the winning approach, but my personal approach on it was to basically get on the table and say, look, there is no doubt this technology is going to change the way that we operate. And if we want to be competitive, if we want to be relevant in the marketplace, we are going to have to dramatically re-engineer the way we, and nobody knows exactly what that's going to look like. So that's sort of the first message. I think to me, honesty about that, the honesty that this is going to change the way we operate, and it could change organizational structure, it could change headcount requirements. That's a journey we have to go on if we want to be relevant. So I think that honesty is important. The second message that I always had to our researchers was, this is how you personally stay relevant. Because I do believe this deeply as a professional, and you know this as a researcher yourself. I mean, if you sat there and crossed your arms and said, I think AI stinks. I'm not going to do that, right? Then 2 years from now, you're not a relevant researcher anymore. So those are the two messages I led with. And as you go through that, there are tough choices you're making around resourcing and everything else that unfold, but at least you're honest about the journey. But I'd just be curious about your reactions in terms of the messaging you're seeing that works with employees on that.
Yeah, but I think that's the right direction, right? It's a human balance, right? It's also, as a leader, being a bit vulnerable. It's vulnerable to say, I'm not exactly sure what this looks like or where this goes. And that's one of the building blocks to creating trust. Mm. And really, this is a huge question of trust, right? If you are going to be brought along and not dragged along, you have to trust the people that are in the driver's seat. You have to think and understand and know that they do have your best interest at heart, but that doesn't mean that they can predict everything or that there aren't mandates coming from above that they can control. And yet you're still going to be behind them because you feel that they're there, right? And that they are to be trusted and that they're not lying to you and that they're not scheming behind your back. And we know that lots of this is a question of communication. But I think that the approach that you're describing is really the right one. It's saying, I'm not exactly sure what the answer is, but I'm actually here for the ride, right? And I know that this is going to be the direction that we need to go in the sense of we can only just be learning and experimenting more in order to try and learn these new tools and how it's going to change things together, because we're on the same team, essentially.
The term you put on the table here, I think, is so important right now in the current environment, and that is trust. And I think that a lot of leadership teams over the past couple of years, and even the AI companies themselves, that is what they lost, was trust with their employees. And this is the first technology I've ever seen roll out in my, 35 years in technology. You know, the internet came and it wasn't like, trust me. The internet didn't shake the trust of employees. It was like, oh, this is cool, whatever. You put a new piece of software in, people use it, and it's like they're not shaken. But AI comes along, and this whole conversation about what does it really mean, the trust levels went way down. And then executive teams do these really bonehead things of saying one thing and suddenly, oh, but we're really going to take out 30% of the people. We didn't really communicate that, or that kind of stuff. And so I think trust, and especially in the United States, is at an all-time low with leadership teams over this particular technology. And I don't see that getting better in the short term. And so I'm curious on that, and this is something we haven't talked about before, but if a leadership team feels like they've dug themselves a hole on this to date, right? Is there any tactics you've seen to help them start to climb out of that? One of them you said is to be as honest as possible. It's okay to be vulnerable and say, hey, we don't have all the answers. Those things help. Anything else help with building that trust back?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first is to actually include people in these decisions to the extent that it's possible, right? It's giving them some sense of agency and control over what feels like a completely uncontrollable situation to them. And again, this is the stress and this is the fear and the threats that are coming from above, from all sides. So in what way can you balance the uncertainty with things that feel controllable and certain? And that can be small things, right? That can be like, hey, let's try to experiment this with each other, right? Let's have a workshop where it's just us kind of poking around and figuring out what works with this, right? It's modeling that it's okay to not know. And this sort of goes back to this question about psychological safety, right? AI adoption requires people to openly learn in public, right? It's trying out a new prompt. It's telling people that you used something in a way that some people still feel like is cheating, right?
Yeah.
It's admitting that you don't trust the output. It's questioning where there are gaps and what they understand and what's going on with the AI. And a precondition for that is that you feel safe to do those things. And a lot of what these rollouts are doing is basically saying, this needs to happen now, it needs to happen fast, and it needs to basically be perfect, right? I better be seeing these efficiency gains immediately. Meanwhile, the rest of us are just trying to figure out how in the world this new technology even works and what it means for us, right? So there has to be space for that, because if it goes too fast, then that is going to jeopardize the rollout just as much as people doing it too slowly.
So one thing I'm picking up on there that you said that has never struck me before, but it really aligns with the patterns I've seen within TSIA, their researchers, as well as I've seen some of our member companies that have been very successful with AI. And that is a concept of co-creation. Because what I heard you just say is if a management team comes together with employees and says, look, we're going to co-create our future together. How do we use these tools? What are the best use cases? Employees get excited about, they get intellectually excited, like I'm part of the solution here. Wow, this is really cool. As opposed to what you just said, the exact opposite of that, of saying, look, we've got the solution, you got to use it, bam. It's got, like you said, up and running and whatever. That jamming, and the crazy thing is with this technology, it is so powerful. It creates opportunity for co-creation in a way that no other technology ever has. Other technologies are like, here's the solution, here's what it does, implement it. This is a technology that you don't even know what the freaking use cases are until you get smart employees starting to play with it. I will tell you, again, I'm so proud of the TSI research team because they've gone on this journey of initial like, hey, do I really have to use AI, you know, blah, 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 to, I mean, they are coming up with new use cases on a weekly basis that we share as a team. And I'm just like, my mind is blown, like how so many creative ways, but they turn that bend of like, hey, I'm really part of the co-creating solution here. You know, this is not being imposed. So that's never really struck me before, but I think about, again, I've watched other member companies and I've watched the employees get excited. It's because they were like, hey, we could create this new solution for our support organization or for our PS organization or for whatever. And they were part of it. It wasn't being imposed, which leads to this other theme that you've referenced about, and I think it's Amy Edmondson's work on psychological safety, this idea that people won't experiment unless, you know, they feel that it's safe doing it. So maybe talk a little bit more about how you make it super safe. And you mentioned some of the things that people, it's okay to make mistakes, et cetera. Anything else to basically build up that psychological safety so they know it's okay to make mistakes, to try and fail, et cetera. What do you see there in the corporate environment?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is role modeling. So related to one of the things I said earlier is even having a meeting where the leader opens up whatever AI you're using and is like, I'm going to try something that I haven't tried before. And I'm going to basically do this with you as an audience so that you can see that it's not perfect, that I don't have all the answers, and that I'm just testing and iterating with the use of this tool. So I think we're not very good at practicing what we preach. We tell other people, you know, you should definitely experiment and you should, you know, go off and kind of just mess with it, right? But then we're like, well, why didn't you finish this in time, right? So making sure that you're actually showing that this is how we should do things, identifying one workflow that you can work on together where the whole point is just to test how you could make it better rather than saying the workflow needs to be better. So it's about the process and it's about how we work with each other. And as you said, right, it's about including people, making them feel like you actually want their brain still and that you're not just asking them to outsource their judgment to a machine, which is not what we want at all. So I think a lot of it, role modeling, showing, actually including processes, a lot of psychological safety is a sense. It's like this feeling that I take for granted that people want to hear my opinion. I take for granted that it's not a risk to speak up. And so having that kind of culture where you're asking people, where you have a meeting where the whole point is to say, let's talk about a mistake that you made with AI, right? I accidentally didn't read the email to the client that AI created, and I shouldn't have done that, right? Mm-hmm. I learned from it though, right? So the whole point of this is that you're learning, that you're getting better, and it's the same thing as it's always been. It's just that we've skipped that whole step when it came to AI because it seemed like AI would fill the gap. And that's been the mistake, right? Is thinking that we didn't need these same basic foundations of learning and iterating and experimenting and having radical candor. And that means being honest about when something didn't work because you used the AI the wrong way, right? And you're learning about this and you're sharing those things and you have to role model that as leaders and you have to implement norms and meeting structures and new ways of doing things that actually include the experimentation within the structure.
So you opened up there with a leader saying, hey, this is how I used AI or how I'm experimenting with it or whatever, right? Sort of showing they're in the game with the employees, right? So it's not an edict. They're not dictating it. I'm a big believer, you know, Tisa, I'm a player coach, right? I have a research team, but I'm also a researcher. And I was a very early adopter of screwing around with AI and seeing how we could use it to do things and then sharing that. And I think that that helped. And in hindsight, I didn't realize how important that actually was. And there was a study that just came out, I think last week, I forget where I read it, that corporations that are having more success with AI, that initiative's, quote, owned by the CEO, right? It's not an AI office. It's not an AI guru, you know, it's the CEO directly says, I am going to steward this. And my gut is that the most success within that are CEOs that are not just dictating, thou shalt use AI. They're probably in there understanding the use cases, really, you know, empathizing, really, they have rolled up their sleeves and they're getting their hands dirty. I bet that is the example for the reasons you said, because then employees can say, okay, they feel the pain, they understand what's working, what's not working. They're part, again, of co-creating with us, and there's not this gap. That, I think, with this technology more than ever, that type of approach is going to prove way more successful than the top down from on high. Mm-hmm. Thou shalt type of approach for
exactly.
Sure.
Yeah, it's exactly. And, you know, it's so interesting as well because Amy Edmondson is also directly applying her work to the AI world and has written lots about it in the last year. And she has this term she calls trust ambiguity, where it's basically that people have the sense that they're supposed to trust the AI, but also not fully. And then, but they can't talk about the mistrust, right? Yeah. So then they stop voicing their concerns, and then they're not catching errors. And that either leads to the detraction or it leads to the AI slop, right? Where they're just using it for everything and people are getting just awful, you know, responses from this person that slows everyone down because it's actually not good. You need a human in the loop. And so this sort of ambiguity of like, you want me to be vulnerable, but I don't think I can be vulnerable about this thing because there were companies that came out just banning use of AI, which is also one of those things where even now looking back, you're going, well, that was a little bit silly.
Exactly. A little dramatic.
You shouldn't use it at all. And so there are still people who are going, well, I'm not really sure. And we're dealing with, you know, confidential information and we have a lot of client information. I'm not really sure how to use it. And our in-house one is really terrible. So all of these kinds of ambiguous, what am I supposed to do with this, is also one of the things that a CEO who goes, hey, let me show you what I'm doing, which gives them permission to do the same thing, is really just like, as you said, hits the nail on the head.
Yeah. Well, that scenario of companies saying, we don't trust it, we've been told either not to use it, or we're not going to, because we tried to use it and we got bad results. I don't hear that as much, but I heard that in early days. Sometimes I still stumble across that with a company. And again, my position on that is such a losing strategy. I mean, for all the things we're talking about around the challenges of rolling out AI and building the trust and doing the admin, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that has to be done there. But the strategy of simply crossing your arms and saying, we don't trust it yet, is beyond, there's no doubt in history, that is a losing strategy for, I don't care what you're doing for a living, I don't care what your company does. But it is amazing, you can still see that, right? Because they just don't know what to do. I'm going to shift gears here. You have this three-circle diagram. The attributes that have to be in place from leadership for people to actually want to follow them on this journey. And I love this diagram. So put it on the table here. So to explain those circles and why they're so important, because again, what you and I are discussing is really how do you get people to lean in and want to be part of it and not resist this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a great question to have now because I think it really brings together what we've been talking about. The idea is that we created this sort of trifecta of the future-ready leader. It's a Venn diagram where these three competencies don't just have to exist in isolation, but they have to actually exist together simultaneously. The first is AI fluency, right? Seems really simple, but it's more than prompting. It's, yes, knowing how to prompt effectively, but it's also about strategic delegation and actually rigorously evaluating outputs and using the technology responsibly and knowing that it's not about getting answers, but what questions you're asking. And that takes practice. It does take upskilling, and it's necessary, right? You have to be able to do that. The other one is strategic agility. So this is sort of your business acumen, your forward exponential thinking. It's being able to have sound judgment through the fog, through the uncertainty, really knowing and being able to think about where the real opportunities are and adapting those with confidence when everything changes. And then the last one is relational intelligence, which is a lot of what we've been talking about. It's the people part, right? It's this genuine willingness to understand what your people are experiencing, to not scoff at the fear, right? To actually understand these threats and then actively create that environment, the one that is psychologically safe, where people are speaking honestly, they're taking risks, they're telling you when they've used AI and how they've used it, they're admitting their mistakes with it. And you're really building that kind of trust that is what makes people choose to come with you. And I think what a lot of people miss is that if you're missing one of them, then the whole thing falls apart in a pretty predictable way, right? Like, you know, here's AI, go make magical things happen. So they have vision, they probably have the technological understanding, but they're missing that last piece, right?
Yeah.
They're announcing, they're not consulting, as we've talked about, they're sort of optimizing, they're not including, and their team is really feeling dragged along. So, and you can imagine the problems when you're missing the other ones as well. So I think this is the leader that knows how to drive the car, right? The fluency. They know where they're going, the strategy. And they've made sure that there's not just room in the car, but there's a reason for everyone else to get in and actually help them get there. So you have to have all three or you're going to go off-roading, right?
So let me play that back because it is a tough time to be a leader in the technology industry for sure, which, you know, what I focus on, but probably any company. Actually, for the very reasons you put on the table there. So if you think about it, let's say if I'm a vice president, an executive vice president, I'm in the C-suite, I've been working for 20, 25, 30 years, right? I didn't grow up with AI. But now, in this current environment, I'm being asked to be an executive, and I agree with the attributes that has these three things. Number one, I can speak AI. I've really clicked in, I'm fluent on it, I understand it. I'm just not reading words, or again, I'm just not dictating something I don't really understand. So that's number one. So that's a curve for a bunch of leaders out there. Number two, I have to have some credible strategy around what this means to our business. And again, that's so fluid right now. That's super hard. And then number three, I have to have this, you know, sort of emotional, you know, capability here to understand that this is a technology that is unlike any other technology we've ever put out. And that my employees are not going to feel safe, but that I've got to create an environment here that I probably, again, in my entire career, I never had to worry about it at that level. So if you put all that on the table, that bar is high. I mean, I do not envy the executives out there. Having said that, that is the bar, because I agree with what you're saying. If you want to be a leader, in 2026, in 2030, whatever, in this, you know, we are in the AI era, whether you like it or not, then you are going to have to be fluid with AI. Number one, you are going to have to start to figure out, and again, I'm co-creating that strategy with your employees is a good thing, talking about being transparent, all the things we talked about, but you are going to have to evolve the strategy of your company. And then you are going to, I think, have to raise, you know, your understanding of how you take people on this journey. I think all three of those notes are going to be critical, but I think we do have to pause and acknowledge it's a high bar. And I'm curious, because this is what you do for a living. You help management teams think about this. I'm sure you go in and you meet executive teams and they're probably zero on all three of those, right? So talk a little bit about how you help them on that journey to say, look, here's where you are. This is where you eventually need to get to if you really want to be an effective leader in today's environment. Talk a little bit about how you take them on that journey.
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, a lot of what I start out by doing is where are they, right? Are they really zero on all of them? Where are their strengths? And where are the gaps? And of course, it's complex within each of these bubbles, right? AI fluency is so much more, as we talked about, than prompting. So maybe they're really good at using Copilot to write their emails, but they're not using it in a strategic way. Or maybe they have really, really strong strategic foresight. But I think, as I said in the keynote, they're running a one-man relay race where they're trying to pass on the baton to a non-existent group of people because they haven't brought them with them, right? Yeah. So I think my experience is that people are worst at the relational part, which is so funny to me. It's ironic because a leader is a relational role, right? The whole definition is in relationship to someone else. And when you ask people, who is the best leader you've ever had and why, they never say they were strategic or they were really good at their job. They say they listened to me, right? They heard what I had to say. They built me up. They guided me, right? And that's because such a big part of it is relational. Now, with that being said, I mean, what we do is, of course, we have experts who come in and help with each of these components, right? You have the Harvard professors who know exactly what to do and how to teach disruption and strategy. And then you have the AI people. And I'm more on the relational side. But I think what I do is I try to help them attach these to each other, right? What does it mean to teach AI fluency and to communicate that to your team with the relational perspective, which is just like we've been talking about today, is first acknowledging that this is actually not a technology problem. This is a, how can I get you even on board to being willing to learn this skill? That's a relational problem. And the strategy as well, right? People are not going to follow somebody who has no strategic foresight, right? Again, it's the trifecta. You can't just be good at the relations and not have either of the other two, right? You have to be able to know where you're going, and people are not going to think it's nice to follow somebody who seems like they don't have their head on their shoulders. Yeah. So thinking about how they're related to each other, I think, is one of the things that is my specialty, in the sense of connecting the dots and making people realize that these things are interconnected and in what way that actually translates to Monday morning.
Yeah, yeah. What's interesting on that, and there was a question I had in queue here that I think really relates to this, because again, you talk about these three boxes. And one thing I see specifically in the technology industry is you do have leaders in these tech companies who are starting to crystallize a vision about what they think AI means to their company, right? So they've got this strategic, they themselves have become very AI savvy, they're fluent, but a complete dead spot on the relational part, like you're talking about. An example I will use, and I hate to pick on companies in a negative way, but I'm going to do it right now, Meta, and what you're reading publicly about Meta. Right. So here's a company that clearly the leadership team is all in on AI. They're thinking about how it's going to change their business model. They're making all these investments. So they're AI fluent for sure. They've got strategy around it. And then they're pushing this out to their workforce and saying, we're going to capture all your keystrokes. And everything that you read, and again, I'm not in that company, I don't know the real deal, but everything that you read secondhand is that these employees culturally are miserable now. They just feel like they're training their replacements, right? And I would argue that they're not resigning because they sort of have the golden handcuffs, right? They're probably super well being paid right now. So, you know, is that a sustainable strategy, right? To have two of those things going and say, well, I'm not going to worry about the relational stuff. If people don't like it, you know, go somewhere else because I can just hire somebody else and just bring them in here. They're interchangeable. You know, when's the bill come due there? What's your perspective on that?
So we all know that fear can be a motivator, but it's very short term. And, you know, it will keep people on their seats for a while, especially if leaving feels risky. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't produce the things that AI success actually requires, right? It doesn't produce the kind of honesty when something doesn't look right. It doesn't produce a willingness to experiment publicly. It doesn't produce motivation, right? It doesn't produce the sort of discretionary effort that it takes. That's sort of at a bare minimum. So you get people who are just a drain. they don't want to leave because it's a good place to be, but they're not helping you succeed in the way that you need them to. And I think AI is a really potent example of this in a way that maybe past, as we've talked about, technologies haven't really been. So the fear is destroying the conditions that actually create the success that you need. So that's the gap between, I think, staying in the seat and actually contributing from where you're sitting. And I would say that maybe the golden handcuffs are solving an exit problem, but definitely not a value problem.
Yeah, I mean, I completely on board that because, again, as we've already discussed, I mean, again, there's AI efficiency, the terms of AI efficiencies, and then there's AI opportunity. And AI opportunity is all the things that you could do that you never realized you could do as a company in terms of value creation, et cetera. And those employees who are in that environment are not going to be about AI opportunity. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be contributing. They're just going to be doing the bare minimum they have to do, not to lose their job or whatever. And I am watching this unfold. We went through the pandemic and we went through a point in time in tech where there just wasn't enough people to go around. Everybody was hiring and employees had put all the power, right? And then with AI, it swung back really hard. And you're watching a lot of these companies act like employees are completely expendable and it's not a problem. If you don't like it, again, go somewhere else. We don't care. This is the way it's going to be, right? And you watch that pendulum go back and forth. And the reality is that the truth is right in the middle. Employees need companies. There's no doubt about it. But yeah. Companies need quality employees. And there's never enough quality employees to go around. So as soon as companies start with that mentality, I predict something like a Meta, they are going to bleed their best talent. Their most creative best talent is not going to stay there. If the culture truly is being reported, they're just going to say, look, this, you know, life's too short and I'm employed and they're going to go. And then, you know, what does that brain drain mean to them in terms of future competitiveness? And I think a lot of companies, leadership teams are not doing the proper calculus right now on this. Yeah. I really deeply believe that. I think they just, you know, swung it too hard and they got to get back to the middle. Employees should appreciate the opportunities, but companies have to realize, you know, if I don't have the right people, I'm not going to be super competitive. That's just the reality.
And also knowing who is the right people, right? As we've been talking about this uber focus on AI skills. I think we talked about this in our conversation, right? Is that in a year or two, that's going to be like saying I'm really proficient at the internet or at my iPhone, right? So that's going to be table stakes. But the differentiator is the human judgment, right? It's knowing what problem is actually worth solving, right? What questions to ask and recognizing crap AI generated output. And the irony is that the better AI gets at generating those answers, the more valuable it's going to become to have people who know when not to trust those answers.
Yeah, for
right?
sure.
And the other thing is that judgment is actually not an individual capability. I know we think it is, but it's something that we express socially. It requires you to do it externally and with other people. And that is an interpersonal risk. So if you don't feel safe on a social level, on a cultural level, then that judgment is not going to be something that you're really exercising. And it's funny because I think this example of the Metas and the, you know, the Elon Musks and the Zuckerbergs is, you know, for decades, organizations have created value by rewarding people for having answers, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. And we know that the organizations that are going to succeed are creating value by rewarding people for asking the better questions, for challenging assumptions and spotting risks and knowing when it's wrong. And those things are dependent on curiosity and candor and the willingness to speak up, right? So I don't think the question is whether fear can build a successful company, because sometimes it clearly can. The question is whether fear creates the kind of human thinking that organizations actually need in an AI era. And I think the answer to that question is no, because we know that the companies that pull ahead are not going to be the ones that have the most AI. They're going to be the ones who have the people who know how to think about it and challenge it and create something that's actually 100%. Genuinely valuable.
Yeah, no, I agree 100% with that. And again, I think companies have to find their way there to appreciate that middle ground of the balance of technology and quality people around it. So I'm watching the clock here. This has been a great conversation. I loved it. It was really good catching up with you. I think you're on a really good square. And again, the keynote that you did that caught my eye really resonated with me because, you know, companies I think are missing the mark right here, right now, in terms of their rollout and enablement and building all the things we talked about, building the trust and co-creating with their employees, et cetera. But for companies that get this right, I mean, it's going to be phenomenal. I'm very bullish on what this AI era is going to look like for employees and their creativity and all that kind of fun stuff. But we got to stick the landing on how we bring employees along the way. And again, I think your work is super relevant there. So I appreciate you coming in and sharing your perspective. And I always end these sessions with a question of the day. And everybody's focused on the first half of AI, worried about efficiencies, et cetera, but it is both half of the sentences here. And so I want to challenge our leadership teams. Are you really thinking about not just rolling AI out, but bringing the employees along the way? Cheers, everybody.